Welcome to The Deep Dive, the show that's really built to give you the ultimate shortcut to being well-informed. We take this massive, sometimes intimidating stack of articles and research,
and we just strip away all the noise.
Exactly. We deliver you the critical knowledge you need to, you know, really grasp the world's most complex and interconnected issues.
And today, we are tackling a beast. I mean, we have the full, comprehensive weekend edition of the Wall Street Journal right here, ready for dissection. It covers everything that happened in the last week of November.
I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and our mission today is truly comprehensive. We're aiming for MECE, mutually exclusive, collectively exhaustive.
Every single piece.
We are diving deep into this massive flow of information moving across global markets, high-stakes geopolitical maneuvers, some transformative technology, and, well, some truly surprising cultural shifts that say a lot about who we are right now.
And I'm Sam Astor. And this is, you know, it's so much more than just a newspaper read. It's a snapshot of a world that is moving incredibly fast. A world where a $1 trillion pharmaceutical company stands right beside a peace proposal that could redefine the map of Europe.
And the slow, grinding reckoning for the failures of the American elite.
That too.
The title of this deep dive is The Wall Street Journal for Saturday, November 22nd, 2025. Okay, let's unpack this. Starting, I think we have to, with the volatility just tearing through the financial world this week.
If we're starting with the markets, we have to look at the crypto space first. The turmoil there hasn't just continued, it has intensified significantly.
The sources confirmed that Bitcoin shed more than 10%.
In the past week alone.
A 10% drop in 1 week. And that's contributed to a staggering $1 trillion broader value erasure from digital currencies since October.
That number, $1 trillion. It's just stunning.
It is. And it means Bitcoin is now on track for its worst monthly results since that infamous crypto winter back in 2022.
What's really critical here is to understand why that drop accelerated so violently. It was driven by massive forced leveraged liquidation.
Right. In just 24 hours leading up to Friday morning, over $2 billion worth of leveraged crypto trades were liquidated.
$2 billion.
For listeners who maybe aren't constantly trading on margin, can you just quickly unpack what that means, what leveraged liquidation is, and why it causes such a severe domino effect?
Sure. Think of leverage as basically borrowing money to amplify your bet. So if you buy Bitcoin using leverage, you have to maintain a certain amount of collateral.
Yeah.
When the price of Bitcoin falls below a certain threshold, they call it the maintenance margin, the exchange automatically sells your holdings to cover their loan. That's the liquidation.
So when $2 billion worth of trades are liquidated almost at the same time,
it creates this massive supply shock. It pushes the price down further, which then triggers more forced selling.
And you get that brutal feedback loop.
Exactly. A brutal feedback loop. That aggressive forced selling is what pushed Bitcoin below that critical $81,000 mark.
And the central irony here, as the sources point out, is that this crypto collapse isn't happening in a vacuum. Some traders are directly linking the drop in Bitcoin to forced selling in the traditional stock markets.
Which suggests that blurring of the lines, you know, the institutional adoption, is now proving to be a liability, not a strength.
It absolutely is. I mean, we read that this was supposed to be crypto's year.
Right. Institutional adoption was booming. BlackRock and Fidelity had launched their, you know, highly anticipated exchange-traded funds.
Even figures like the Trump family have these sprawling crypto businesses. The whole narrative was that crypto was finally independent of that speculative boom and bust cycle.
But the primary shock catalyst wasn't some, you know, flaw in a blockchain network. It was pure high-stakes geopolitics.
Exactly. The source material pinpoints President Trump's surprise announcement on October 10th.
The new tariffs against China, potentially crippling tariffs.
That single event, which was focused entirely on global trade, triggered a sell-off that forced exchanges to liquidate over $19 billion worth of trades globally.
Across all asset classes.
Which just confirms that these digital assets, which were once touted as, you know, being independent of fiat currency and government policy, are now highly sensitive to global trade wars and presidential tweets.
And that geopolitical anxiety has certainly created a broad market shakeup. The sources show the S&P 500 fell nearly 2% for the week.
And it's now down 3.5% in November.
The NASDAQ, the tech-heavy index, did even worse. It lost 2.7% for the week and suffered a pretty painful 6.1% drop this month.
That kind of sustained November sell-off has deeply soured sentiment.
Oh, absolutely. We're seeing investors sell off about $4 billion of Bitcoin and Ether ETFs just this month alone.
And even a company like MicroStrategy, which pioneered the whole corporate crypto treasury model.
Their market cap has been more than halved from its peak. It just shows that the high expectations from earlier this year have completely evaporated under the weight of market volatility and trade uncertainty.
I do have to mention the one small piece of levity in this whole segment.
The anecdote, yeah.
The anecdote about the crypto executive who, when Bitcoin fell to $86,000, was apparently more worried about his kidney stones than the market dip.
Claiming, crypto kills nerves. If you're in crypto long enough, none of this stuff fazes you.
It suggests either, I don't know, genuine resilience or just utter exhaustion.
Maybe a bit of both. But shifting our focus from the volatile markets to the institution that's supposed to be stabilizing them, the Federal Reserve, we see an equally intense internal conflict brewing.
And it's being made worse by all the political pressure.
Right. This brings us squarely to the Fed's interest rate dilemma.
The sources highlight that President Trump has publicly stated he expects much lower interest rates once he installs a new Federal Reserve chair next May.
That isn't subtle pressure.
Not at all. It's a direct expectation setting.
And it's manifesting in this growing internal resistance to the possibility of a rate cut in December. Mm-hmm. The current chair, Jerome Powell, is facing opposition that is rising mostly among the Reserve Bank presidents.
Even among those who had previously backed the cuts in September and October.
Exactly. And this internal division is so much more than just a policy disagreement. It risks breaking the long-standing Fed culture of consensus.
Wait, if that consensus breaks down, how significant is that historically? And what does this division mean for the perception of the Fed's independence, which is supposed to be, you know, sacrosanct?
It's highly significant. The sources remind us that there have only been 5 meetings with 3 dissenting votes since 1993.
Wow.
So the prospect of 3 or more dissents in December, regardless of what Powell decides, means the Fed's carefully managed image of unity is just shattering.
And Fed veterans are worried.
They're worried that if the institutional structure, that 12-member FOMC, which includes the non-political appointees, proves resistant, Trump might take even more forceful steps.
Like trying to dismiss or intimidate governors and regional presidents.
Exactly. And the political pressure is already explicit, isn't it?
It is. We see the push to remove Governor Lisa Cook over alleged financial wrongdoing, which she vehemently denies.
And then there's the reporting that Trump explicitly pressed Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent to work on Powell to lower rates.
Threatening that he would publicly blame Bessent if the Fed failed to cut.
That kind of environment creates a really dangerous dynamic for the Fed. Trump's stated economic policies, especially on aggressive trade tariffs and severe immigration restrictions, they introduce friction into the economic system.
They tend to weaken job growth by increasing costs for businesses.
And they push up consumer prices because of supply restrictions.
Which puts the Fed in an impossible position.
It does. They're trying to fight inflation that's running closer to 3% than their 2% target, while at the same time worrying about weakening labor markets.
That is the ultimate policy nightmare. It's a stagflation-like scenario that central banks are just not well equipped to handle.
But just as the market was digesting all this internal dissent, a key development happened late in the week that really shifted expectations.
That was the intervention by New York Fed President John Williams, a key Powell ally.
And maybe the most important regional voice. Williams publicly supported a rate reduction in the near term, saying he still sees room for a further adjustment.
And the sources note the impact was immediate.
Instantaneous. Investors reacted instantly, boosting the market odds of a December cut from around 40% to over 70%.
That is just a fascinating display of power.
Mm.
Williams is known for being extremely measured.
Very.
So his support, which is basically signaling Powell's leaning, completely overshadowed the dissent from the other regional presidents.
It implies that while the internal divisions are very real, the core leadership is still aligned toward easing conditions.
Mostly to avoid a policy mistake that would make the economic slowdown even worse.
Exactly. It shows the gravitational pull of the New York Fed and the chair's office still holds sway, even if that culture of consensus is straining. It's a fascinating barometer of how much internal stress the Fed can handle while still maintaining market confidence.
Okay, from the turbulence of the markets and the internal struggles of the Fed, let's pivot now to the shifting powers of corporate America, where innovation is creating trillion-dollar fortunes while, you know, global shifts force others to retrench.
The story of corporate performance this week really highlights the extremes of modern capitalism. Take Eli Lilly, the pharmaceutical giant.
They have officially become the first pharma company to hit a staggering $1 trillion in market capitalization.
$1 trillion?
For a drug company. That is just a monumental achievement, and it's propelled entirely by one specific market.
The booming demand for their GLP-1 weight loss drugs, Mounjaro and Zepbound.
What's so fascinating here is that Eli Lilly isn't just a participant in this market. They are now overtaking the early leader.
Right. The sources confirm that Mounjaro and Zepbound are surpassing Novo Nordisk's blockbuster competitors Ozempic and Wegovy in U.S. prescription volume.
It just signals that the weight loss drug market isn't a passing fad. It's so vast that it can mint not just billion-dollar, but trillion-dollar companies.
Fundamentally reshaping how we think about health and chronic conditions.
And that incredible ascent stands in such stark contrast to the challenges faced by older, less agile industries.
Well, look at Tyson Foods. They're preparing to close one of their largest beef processing plants in Nebraska.
And this isn't a problem of flagging consumer demand for meat.
No, it's a supply-side crisis, a persistent U.S. cattle shortage that is squeezing the entire meatpacking sector, forcing consolidation and closures.
It just shows the fragility of global supply chains and agricultural strains colliding with the sheer speed of pharmaceutical innovation.
And speaking of stratospheric market caps and transformative technology, let's talk about the AI arms race.
Specifically, AMD's aggressive challenge to NVIDIA.
Who's usually framed as the undisputed king of AI chips.
It really is a classic David versus Goliath story, isn't it?
It is. AMD CEO Lisa Su made this radical, massive strategic pivot in late 2022, centering the entire $330 billion company around AI infrastructure.
And she argues that the AI market is not a zero-sum game.
Right. She aims to capture a significant double-digit piece of the market share that's currently dominated by NVIDIA.
And she is certainly landing the high-profile deals needed to back that claim up. AMD secured landmark partnerships with Oracle and, crucially, with OpenAI.
For its most powerful chip yet, the MI450.
And that OpenAI deal, we should dig into that because it raises some serious questions about the sustainability and the structure of this whole AI boom.
It really does. The deal includes warrants that allow OpenAI to buy up to 10% of AMD stock.
So essentially, a customer is being given a large stake in their supplier.
Exactly. So if OpenAI succeeds using AMD chips, AMD stock rises, OpenAI makes money.
Which they can then use to buy more AMD chips. It creates this kind of circular funding structure.
That sounds highly concentrated and, frankly, potentially unsustainable if the AI bubble bursts.
Precisely.
Oh.
And it fuels that investor nervousness we've already seen, with NVIDIA shares falling 12% in November.
All fueled by those fears of an AI bubble. Su, however, is tremendously bullish. She's increased her forecast for the AI and data center computing market to reach $1 trillion annually by 2030.
It's a massive jump from her earlier forecast of $500 billion by 2028.
She sees diversification as inevitable, and AMD is capitalizing on the fact that NVIDIA just cannot produce enough chips to satisfy the current explosive demand.
And AMD is gaining traction not just on capability, but also on price, right? Offering chips that are significantly less expensive.
They are. And meanwhile, Su isn't just fighting in the data center. She's fighting in Washington, D.C.
She's become a major player in the lobbying game.
A huge player. She's actively advocating against strict export controls aimed at cutting off advanced chip sales.
Arguing that these controls just hurt AMD's ability to gain crucial market share overseas.
And her critical point is that these restrictions ultimately benefit Chinese rivals, especially Huawei, by creating a domestic vacuum that U.S. companies are prohibited from filling.
It's a subtle but very powerful argument against U.S. foreign policy stifling domestic competition.
And this entire AI infrastructure theme brings us to a really fascinating intersection with energy policy.
The scale of the demand is just staggering.
The chips needed for that OpenAI deal alone require 6 gigawatts of data center capacity.
6 gigawatts. That's enough electricity to power 4.5 million average homes for a year.
And that kind of relentless, massive power demand is fundamentally changing the energy landscape. The sources detail a huge, unexpected development.
Constellation Energy is getting a $1 billion federal loan to restart the previously undamaged reactor at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania.
Three Mile Island, the site of the famous 1979 accident.
That is a serious signal.
It is. And the move is explicitly intended to power Microsoft's rapidly expanding AI business.
So this is nuclear power making a comeback, not driven by geopolitical crises or even climate necessity alone.
But by the voracious, immediate power requirements of AI data centers, it's a remarkable illustration of how AI is shaping industrial policy.
And beyond AI, we are seeing concrete evidence of a broader structural shift in global manufacturing.
The reshoring efforts that have been talked about for years are now translating into real investment.
Absolutely. GE Appliances, for example, awarded $150 million in contracts to American suppliers as it prepares to move some manufacturing back from China.
And Nokia, too, is putting down roots, investing an additional $4 billion in U.S.-based manufacturing and R&D.
These moves just signal a strategic de-risking by corporate America. They're adapting to a new world of heightened trade tensions and tariffs by prioritizing domestic and regional supply chains.
This entire section really paints a picture of massive volatility. Financial systems are strained, corporate winners are wildly wealthy, and the geopolitical risks are forcing production back home.
Which brings us neatly to the most critical geopolitical flashpoint right now, the fate of the war in Ukraine.
The situation in Ukraine is approaching a severe crisis point, and it's being driven entirely by U.S. political pressure.
The sources confirm that President Trump is pressing Kyiv to accept a sweeping U.S. deal to end the war.
And the initial deadline he proposed was Thanksgiving.
Less than a week away, an ultimatum essentially right before the holidays.
And this 28-point plan is described as being heavily tilted toward Russia. It contains major concessions that Kyiv has long declared non-negotiable.
So what are the most difficult provisions that Zelensky and his government are being forced to consider?
They are deeply painful. The plan includes significant territorial concessions, forcing Ukraine to withdraw troops from parts of the eastern Donetsk region that are still under Kyiv's control.
It also mandates a hard cap on Ukraine's military size.
Down to 600,000 personnel, from the current strength of around 900,000. And it explicitly forecloses Ukraine's long-standing goal of joining NATO.
But perhaps the most morally objectionable point for Ukrainians is the demand for general amnesty?
That is the provision that Ukrainians find particularly galling. The plan includes general amnesty for actions taken by all parties during the war,
which would effectively shield Russian personnel from prosecution for potential war crimes committed on Ukrainian soil.
And on top of that, the plan demands Kyiv hold elections in these newly defined territories within 100 days, forcing political stabilization on Russia's terms.
President Zelensky's reaction just confirms the immense existential gravity of this moment.
He called this one of the most difficult moments in Ukraine's history. He's balancing what he called loss of dignity or the risk of losing a major concession to Russia.
It sounds like the choice is between political suicide or national humiliation.
And the leverage the U.S. is applying is immense and very direct. If Ukraine refuses, the threat of withdrawing crucial U.S. intelligence and weapons assistance is real.
When asked about Zelensky's likely dissatisfaction with the deal, Trump was blunt.
He stated he'll have to like it. And if he doesn't like it, then, you know, they should just keep fighting.
That just puts Kyiv in an untenable position.
And the reaction from Moscow seems to confirm how favorable this deal is for them.
It does. President Putin confirmed he had received the draft from the Americans.
And stated that the U.S. plan could form the basis for a peace settlement.
This has forced Zelensky to scramble, seeking urgent advice from European allies and even sending officials to Washington.
To consult with U.S. figures like Vice President J.D. Vance and Army Secretary Dan Driscoll, hoping to find some path out of this domestic and international corner.
Moving from the conflict itself to the economic measures intended to curtail it, U.S. sanctions are clearly reshaping global oil markets.
They're trying to financially starve Russia's war machine.
And the new U.S. sanctions targeting Lukoil and Rosneft, Russia's largest oil producers, have had a measurable impact on global supply lines.
Since the sanctions were announced, the price of Russia's flagship Urals oil grade is down about 17%. It's trading at its biggest discount to Brent crude since 2023.
That's direct evidence that the sanctions are working to depress Russian revenues, which is the primary goal.
It is. But what's the consequential global ripple effect of this action?
The disruption is enormous. Traditional, massive buyers of Russian oil, specifically China and India, are now being forced to look farther afield.
To suppliers like Brazil, Canada, and Guyana to meet their needs, India's Reliance Industries, a massive importer of Russian crude, has stopped purchases entirely.
And the sanctions have simultaneously caused shipping costs to spike.
the daily rate for large crude carriers jumped over 48% due to the increased risk and necessary rerouting.
The most visual statistic from this section for me is the physical volume of oil disruption.
That would be the 1.4 billion barrels of oil currently stranded on water globally.
1.4 billion. To put that in perspective,
that volume is the highest level in years and three times the size of the entire U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve. It illustrates a massive physical blockage in the supply chain.
And given that oil and gas account for up to a third of Russia's federal budget revenues,
the U.S. Treasury's claim that sanctions are succeeding in starving Putin's war machine holds tangible weight. It limits Moscow's ability to fund the war effort while keeping its domestic economy stable.
It forces hard choices on the Kremlin about where to put their resources.
Exactly. Now, shifting focus to the Middle East, the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia has undergone a rapid, radical transformation under this administration.
Particularly with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS.
MBS recently emerged from a White House visit designated by President Trump as the undisputed leader of the Arab world.
Receiving a notably lavish welcome, including a black tie dinner, despite all the ongoing human rights scrutiny.
It just signals a complete shift in priorities. The dynamic has moved away from that old unspoken agreement of Saudi oil for American security.
So what is the new transactional nature of this relationship?
It is centered almost entirely on economics and military hardware. MBS promised to increase Saudi investment in the U.S. economy from $600 billion to an astounding $1 trillion.
$1 trillion.
And in exchange, MBS received two major deliverables: designation as a major non-NATO ally and a promise for the sale of the advanced F-35 jet fighter.
Making Saudi Arabia the first Arab country to receive that technology.
Which gives MBS immense diplomatic leverage, both regionally and globally.
And finally, in the Gaza region, the U.S. is actively planning for the future, moving forward with a pretty controversial proposal regarding the population.
The U.S. is pushing ahead with plans to build alternative safe communities for Palestinians in Israeli-controlled areas of Gaza.
What U.S. officials are calling the Green Zone. The first site is planned for Rafah.
And this is a tacit, though difficult, acknowledgement that the Trump administration recognizes the disarming of Hamas won't happen soon, even though it's a key part of the broader peace plan.
So the idea seems to be to create pockets of stability that could model future reconstruction and draw Gazams away from Hamas-controlled areas. But what are the major risks associated with this green zone strategy?
It faces significant opposition. Critics worry it risks permanently dividing Gaza and subjecting parts of it to non-Palestinian control, potentially long-term.
Egypt, in particular, has expressed concern.
Right. They're worried that concentrating Gozans and Rafah could be a prelude to a larger, forced population shift across the border into the Sinai Peninsula.
And Hamas, meanwhile, views the plan as undermining Palestinian political rights.
And is refusing to disarm or recognize the zone's authority. The long-term success of this hinges entirely on the ability of a yet-to-be-formed international security force to stabilize these zones.
That's a comprehensive view of the global chessboard. We've covered everything from peace ultimatums and financial warfare to the military balance in the Middle East. Let's now bring our focus back home to the domestic political battles and legal rulings shaping American life.
We can begin with the judiciary, where the fight over congressional representation continues. Texas asked the Supreme Court this week to immediately reinstate its newly drawn congressional map.
This mid-decade redistricting plan, which was enacted after a direct push by President Trump, could help Republicans gain up to 5 House seats.
And Justice Samuel Alito temporarily restored the map while the Supreme Court considers the full challenge.
What's the core legal argument Texas is making to justify this highly partisan move?
They're appealing a lower court ruling that had blocked the map. Their argument centers on a fundamental legal distinction. They claim the lower court incorrectly branded their partisan gerrymander as a racial one.
So Texas insists that while the lines were drawn explicitly to favor Republicans, which is often permissible,
they were not drawn specifically to dilute minority voting power, which is often illegal. It just highlights the incredible difficulty the courts face in disentangling partisan intent from racial impact in modern redistricting battles.
It also highlights the broader reality that both parties are masters of drawing favorable lines.
Oh, absolutely. The sources note that while Democrats denounce the Texas move as anti-democratic, California voters recently overwhelmingly approved a redistricting plan that could net Democrats 5 seats of their own.
It's a truly bipartisan effort to maximize power through map drawing.
It is. Now, shifting to federal agencies, we have an important ruling on civil liberties and data sharing between two major arms of government, the IRS and ICE.
A federal judge blocked the IRS data sharing pact with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, finding the policy unlawful.
This is significant because the IRS had been turning over tens of thousands of taxpayers' addresses to ICE.
So Judge Colleen Collar-Cotelli's ruling is a major check on interagency data sharing.
It is. She limited the use of information that has already been shared, stating it could only be used for non-tax criminal investigations.
This ruling really affirms a protection for taxpayers, ensuring that highly sensitive personal information collected for tax purposes can't be just indiscriminately weaponized for civil immigration enforcement.
And in other IRS news, there is a temporary and probably welcome reprieve for certain low and middle income workers regarding tips.
The IRS is temporarily delaying enforcement of a provision of the No Tax on Tips law.
This specific provision restricts the deduction for workers in what's termed a specified service trade or business, or SSTB.
So by delaying enforcement, certain tip workers will be allowed to claim larger deductions and subsequent refunds for next spring's tax season.
It's a technical tax break, but it translates into real money for service workers in the short term.
Now, for maybe the most surprising domestic political story in the sources, a prominent Republican figure announcing her immediate resignation.
That would be Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, who announced she will resign from Congress at the start of next year.
And the driving force behind this is the total implosion of her relationship with President Trump,
who recently disowned her publicly and called her wacky.
Her rationale for leaving is incredibly telling, though. It suggests a deep pessimism about the future of the party.
She predicted that Republicans will lose the midterms anyway, which she believes would inevitably lead to Trump's impeachment.
She framed her departure in such dramatic personal terms.
She explicitly stated she didn't want her district to have to endure a hurtful and hateful primary against me by the president we all fought for.
And she refused to be a battered wife, hoping the conflict would disappear.
Which suggests a recognition that the political cost of fighting Trump's preferred candidates locally would simply be too high, win or lose.
And the split wasn't based on minor issues. She had broken with Trump on core policy points, including the economy, foreign policy.
And most notably, she joined GOP allies and Democrats to force a vote to release Justice Department files related to Jeffrey Epstein.
A move Trump initially objected to vehemently.
Yeah.
That suggests the wedge was deep and ideological.
That Epstein file vote is a small detail that reveals a massive gulf. It shows that even those who were once staunchly loyal are willing to challenge him on issues of transparency and accountability.
Especially when it's related to the elite's behavior.
Right. Now, shifting to campaign finance, the Democratic National Committee is showing clear signs of financial strain following their post-2024 election losses.
The DNC took out a $15 million loan in October, specifically to bolster finances ahead of the midterms.
And the contrast with their rivals is just striking. The Republican National Committee, the RNC, is debt-free and holds significantly larger cash reserves.
Around $91 million compared to the DNC's approximately $18
million. The sources note that the DNC's debt level, when adjusted for inflation, is higher than any level it had recorded since early 2014.
And while DNC officials defend the loan as strategic, claiming investing early builds power and helped propel recent victories in Virginia and New Jersey, that financial disparity is a clear structural warning sign for the party.
It is heading into a critical election cycle. It forces them to operate with less flexibility.
Meanwhile, at the local governance level, we see Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson facing fierce political pushback against his proposed head tax.
Johnson's proposal for a $21 per employee head tax on businesses with over 100 workers was overwhelmingly rejected, 25 to 10, by the City Council's Finance Committee.
So what was the core resistance here?
Critics, including business leaders and many council members, warned that this tax would only exacerbate the ongoing downtown dysfunction.
And crucially, would inevitably shift the tax burden onto homeowners as commercial property values continue to decline.
And Chicago property taxes already surged by 16.7% last year.
But Mayor Johnson is doubling down, claiming there is no correlation between taxation and the success, if you will, of corporations.
That quote just reveals a fundamental disconnect with basic economic theory.
It suggests he believes business location and investment decisions are entirely immune to tax rates. That ideological stance is clearly creating political conflict, even within his own party.
It illustrates the high stakes of urban governance right now. The argument is over who pays for city services and whether taxing businesses just drives them away, worsening the overall tax base.
The disconnect between City Hall's contested economic theories and real-world behavior often plays out in surprising ways. And speaking of surprising behavior, let's take a sharp turn from politics and finance to the quirky cultural trends shaping how Americans celebrate, consume, and escape.
As we approach the Thanksgiving holiday, the sources detail the commercialization of a modern family tradition known universally as the Cousin Walk.
The Cousin Walk. The clandestine operation where a small group quietly excuses themselves from the dinner table.
Usually to smoke cannabis.
Before rejoining the festivities, theoretically returning as a paragon of wit and insight, though usually just high and extremely hungry.
And this specific localized tradition has now become a full-blown, commercially recognized event. The day before Thanksgiving is now known in the industry as Green Wednesday.
And it has quickly established itself as the second biggest day for cannabis sales in the country, trailing only 420.
The corporate tie-ins here are both subtle and hilarious. Mainstream snack businesses are now slyly marketing to this tradition.
Jif Peanut Butter, for instance, ran an Instagram ad showing a squeeze pouch tucked into a jacket with the caption, "Pre-Thanksgiving Dinner Cousin Walk."
And New York dispensaries have released special, odor-proof, travel-friendly joints specifically packaged for the secret society.
The social function of the walk is also being explicitly marketed. A new public service announcement from the Cannabis Media Council, targeted at the 65-plus demographic,
suggests the walk is an essential escape valve from obnoxious relative conversations, be it about volatile crypto markets or vaccination debates.
It speaks to the broader societal shift toward cannabis acceptance, even if Congress is simultaneously trying to push back.
By recently narrowing the definition of legal hemp products, specifically targeting nationally sold gummies and drinks made with hemp-derived THC.
It's a culture moving faster than the law.
Definitely. And moving from the family dinner table to the cinema, we're seeing another significant demographic shift in Hollywood.
The return of the PG movie.
For decades, the PG-13 rating ruled the box office, fueled by the Marvel superhero franchises and blockbusters designed to maximize appeal across teens and adults.
But now, Hollywood's most reliable audience is much younger 10-year-olds, and they're driving the box office success of PG-rated movies.
This is due to a profound shift in consumer behavior among Gen Alpha kids and preteens. They now prefer theaters more than Gen Z, Millennials, or Gen X.
They're seeking these immersive, social, and participatory fandom experiences, singing along, dressing up, that make the movie itself an event shared with friends.
Something Gen Z often finds too costly or inconvenient, and the box office evidence is undeniable.
TG movies like Zootopia 2, Wicked, For Good, a Minecraft movie, and the live-action Lilo and Stitch are currently topping the gross charts.
They're defying the poor performance of many R-rated or original PG-13 films.
Theater executives are responding by prioritizing this younger demographic, often scheduling multiple PG animated films over R-rated horror films when setting up their screens.
It's an explicit recognition that the family market is the most dependable revenue source in a volatile content landscape.
Finally, let's turn to the quest for fast food innovation, starring the person who the sources dub the GOAT of limited time offers, or LTOs.
That title belongs to Liz Matthews, Taco Bell's chief food innovation officer. Her job is essentially to create viral, irresistible LTOs, but under extremely strict constraints.
They have to use existing equipment and existing ingredients.
And they must maintain that sub-$5 price point that defines Taco Bell's brand identity. That constraint is what makes the job an art form.
Her past hits are legendary, and they're evidence of her genius. She helped develop the proprietary Mountain Dew flavor Baja Blast,
which is now a top seller everywhere, not just at Taco Bell, and of course, the Doritos Locos Tacos,
which drove hundreds of millions in sales and single-handedly reversed a sales slump back in 2012.
Her current challenge is perhaps her biggest culinary holy grail, the cheese shell challenge.
Taco Bell has been working for nearly a decade on inventing a taco shell made entirely of crispy cheese.
And they're struggling to keep it structurally sound and prevent it from disintegrating upon delivery.
That is the crucial constraint, isn't it? If they sell it as a crispy cheese taco, the product has to deliver on that promise.
Exactly. As one product developer told her, if you're talking about it as a crispy cheese taco, you've got to deliver crispy cheese.
Matthews remains optimistic, though, emphasizing her team's fearless experimental culture.
Their innovations are designed to appeal to that specific demographic. The 18 to 30-year-olds leaving a party on a Saturday night, the cultural rebels who embody the Taco Bell mindset.
From the cultural rebels craving crispy cheese to the highest echelons of power, we must now pivot sharply to a difficult but necessary topic: accountability and the lingering corrosive shadow of Jeffrey Epstein.
This section details the slow, delayed, but ultimately total collapse of Lawrence Summers, the former Treasury Secretary and Harvard president.
The sources show that his extensive long-term ties to Jeffrey Epstein, which were once shielded by his immense network and power, are finally costing him his career.
And the timeline of their association is what makes this reckoning so critical. Summers maintained a personal relationship with Epstein long after Epstein's 2008 conviction for soliciting minors in Florida.
He just continued the relationship, seemingly insulated from public criticism.
The historical connections are crucial. During Summers' Harvard presidency from 98 to 2008, Epstein contributed $9.17 million to the university.
This included a $6.5 million pledge that established the Program for Evolutionary Dynamics,
which, critically, gave Epstein a campus office. He used that office, visiting Harvard more than 40 times between 2010 and 2018, long after his conviction was public knowledge.
And Summers even solicited Epstein's help for a personal philanthropy project.
For his wife's online poetry project. But it took the release of shockingly personal messages years later to finally break the seal on his career and trigger the institutional response.
Yes. The immediate cause was the release of messages from 2018 and 2019, right up until the day before Epstein's arrest.
And these messages showed Summers asking Epstein for advice on pursuing a romantic relationship with the Chinese economist, Qiu Jin.
Epstein was explicitly acting as his wingman,
offering romantic advice and even calling Summers' attraction game day, I'm fed.
This revelation just exposed the duration, intimacy, and dependency of their association, confirming that Summers valued this relationship long after the full extent of Epstein's crimes was widely known.
And the consequences, once they started, were swift and total. It demonstrates how the elite network can instantly dissolve once the moral pressure becomes unbearable.
Summers has resigned from the OpenAI board and taken leave from his teaching duties.
He's lost influential positions with the New York Times, the Center for American Progress, Santander, Bloomberg TV, and the Yale Budget Lab. Harvard is also conducting a fresh review of his ties.
The analysis from a former colleague summed it up devastatingly, saying Summers' ego always trumped his IQ, and it's now done so in the worst possible way.
This entire story, the delayed nature of the reckoning, it continues to resonate years after Epstein's death. Why?
Peggy Noonan's analysis in the sources offers a powerful and profound explanation that goes beyond just simple scandal.
Noonan argues that the Epstein story endures because it is fundamentally a failure of the 21st century elite.
It's not just about the actions of a few bad actors. It's about a class of successful, powerful people who looked away.
It is a story about unloved girls and the systems that failed to protect them. The failure, she argues, was one of moral authority.
And how did the elite rationalize looking away? According to Noonan,
she suggests they became embarrassed by the idea of wielding moral authority. They preferred not to be seen as unsophisticated or priggish, or worse, a Karen.
So instead of exercising moral judgment and cutting off ties immediately, which they had the power to do, they looked away.
Prioritizing network access, donations, and intellectual connection over protecting vulnerable children.
The ultimate betrayal, in Noonan's view, is that these powerful people were given everything by American opportunity, couldn't even adhere to the basic standards necessary to protect kids.
That concept, the failure of moral authority among those who run the institutions, is a searing summation and a crucial lens through which to view these ongoing scandals.
From the failures of moral leadership, let's transition now to the ongoing policy debates across the Atlantic and here at home that reveal current economic struggles and structural gaps.
Looking across the pond, the UK economy is facing severe challenges. UK borrowing exceeded projections by £9.9 billion in October.
As a result, Treasury Chief Rachel Reeves is expected to announce a significant fiscal correction next week.
About £20 billion in tax increases and spending cuts designed to meet budget rules.
Meanwhile, the Eurozone is struggling with sluggish growth, particularly hurt by its manufacturing sector.
Business activity in the Eurozone grew slightly slower in November. The Composite Purchasing Managers Index, the PMI, dipped to 52.4.
For context, the PMI is a key monthly economic indicator. Anything below 50 signals contraction.
And the manufacturing component hit a five-month low. Analysts are saying it's far too early to be optimistic about Europe's near-term outlook, especially with manufacturing weakness persisting in key nations like Germany.
And ECB President Christine Lagarde is urgently calling for structural change to address this persistent weakness.
Urging Europe to move away from its historic reliance on an export-driven growth model, she points to profound existing internal barriers within the EU's goods and services markets.
Internal frictions that she estimates are equivalent to massive tariffs, ranging from 65% to 100%.
She argues the only way forward is to break down these barriers by adopting majority voting on critical fiscal issues like VAT rules and corporate tax bases, rather than allowing individual member states veto power.
She sees internal integration as the key to economic resilience.
Now, coming back stateside, a significant financial trend propagated by so-called finfluencers is challenging decades of traditional retirement advice.
Specifically regarding Social Security benefits.
This is a textbook example of why the sources caution against taking complex financial advice from short-form social media.
These financial influencers are urging people to claim Social Security early, at age 62, specifically so they can take those benefits and immediately invest them in the stock market.
Claiming the market will provide higher long-term returns.
So what is the traditional expert rebuttal to this high-risk strategy?
It's overwhelmingly deemed a dumb idea for the vast majority of people with efficient assets. Delaying benefits until age 70 results in a 77% higher inflation-adjusted, risk-free monthly benefit guaranteed for life.
So comparing the stock market, which is volatile, a roller coaster,
to Social Security, which is guaranteed, indexed to inflation, and acts as an escalator, is a fundamentally flawed comparison.
If the stock market crashes, that money is gone. Social Security is reliable, guaranteed income that protects against longevity risk.
So for listeners who have sizable fixed assets, what is the optimal conservative strategy according to the sources?
The optimal strategy is to draw down your fixed income assets, like bonds or CDs, to cover living expenses during the years between retirement and age 70.
This allows you to delay claiming Social Security until the benefits are fully maximized, locking in the highest possible guaranteed income later in life without forcing you to liquidate stock holdings during a market downturn.
It's about maximizing guaranteed income, not chasing speculative returns.
Exactly. And finally, let's address the persistent problem of the skills gap in America, where employers struggle to find workers with necessary technical skills.
The source material argues that the blame is often misplaced.
The skills gap is severe, and frustration often gets directed toward community colleges, which are sometimes seen as purely remedial or lacking relevant programs.
However, the president of Northern Virginia Community College pushes back strongly on this.
Institutions like hers are actively designing and delivering high-demand programs, welding, automotive technology, cybersecurity, data center operations, in direct conjunction with major regional employers like Amazon Web Services and Micron.
So the demand from students is there, but the ability to deliver the necessary supply is capped by a different kind of gap entirely.
Precisely. Student demand often outpaces the physical capacity and funding for these programs. The core takeaway here is that closing the skills gap requires closing the funding gap.
Community colleges receive far less state support per student than four-year universities.
Right. In Virginia, for example, community colleges receive only about 57 cents in state support for every dollar that goes to a public four-year university.
And since vocational and technical programs are often the most expensive to run,
requiring specialized equipment and smaller class sizes,
this funding disparity prevents them from scaling up the exact programs employers need most.
We've covered the global economy, the corporate battlefield, and domestic policy debates. To conclude our comprehensive deep dive, let's transition from policy and finance to a larger, more abstract question about what defines and holds the United States together as a nation as we approach a major anniversary.
We're just around the corner from our nation's 250th anniversary. And historian Gordon S. Wood's perspective on American identity, featured in the sources, is highly relevant to our current polarized moment.
His core argument is that the U.S. is fundamentally different from nearly every other nation.
He argues that countries like Germany or Japan were already established as coherent nations, built on a prior common ethnicity, language, or tribal history before they became modern states.
And America reversed that process.
Precisely. The U.S. created a governing state, a structure, before it had a unified nation of people.
Wood concludes that because of this unique beginning, to be an American is not to be someone defined by blood or origin, but to believe in something.
The ideals of liberty and equality, enshrined in the Declaration of Independence, act as the electric cord that links wildly diverse people together across time and geography.
Lincoln famously cemented this idea, noting that in his time, half the American people had no direct blood connection to the revolutionaries of 1776.
Yet the foundational principles in the Declaration linked them, making them blood of the blood in spirit.
This concept of a creedal nation relies heavily, Wood notes, on assimilation, the process of melting this hodgepodge of people, as John Adams once put it, into a people who share and prioritize those core ideals.
However, Wood offers a vital caution regarding the limits of this unique American ability to absorb.
What is that caution?
Wood cautions that while America is uniquely capable of integrating diverse populations, no nation should allow the foreign-born percentage to exceed about 15% without careful, sustained handling and emphasis on assimilation into the core creed.
He suggests that if the national emphasis shifts entirely towards celebrating diversity without reinforcing the common political bond, the unity required for a functioning state might fray.
And that is the ultimate provocative question to leave with you, the listener. As we celebrate our diversity, which is clearly growing, as we've seen through cultural trends and political discourse, are we adequately prioritizing and reinforcing the core creedal principles, liberty and equality, necessary to maintain the unity that holds our incredibly diverse nation together?
That is the thread that connects all these disparate stories.
Absolutely. We have traversed the financial landscape, tracking the astonishing ascent of Eli Lilly to a $1 trillion market cap alongside the aggressive chip war waged by AMD against NVIDIA.
We've tracked the catastrophic global supply line disruption caused by Russia sanctions and the shocking geopolitical implications of the Ukraine peace ultimatum.
And we've examined the unexpected corporate tie-ins to the cousin walk, the total legal and professional fallout of Lawrence Summers' ties to Jeffrey Epstein,
the high-stakes political chess game over the Texas gerrymander, and the fundamental financial folly of blindly following finfluencer advice on Social Security.
The interconnectedness of these events, from nuclear reactors powering AI data centers to revelations of moral failure affecting political stability, is exactly why we take this deep dive.
Thank you for joining us for this comprehensive look at the Wall Street Journal for Saturday, November 22nd, 2025.
Until next time. Keep exploring the source material and questioning the foundations of what you know.